This is the second session of an interview with John Prescott on the 25th of October 2006 for the University of Adelaide Oral History. Interviewer Rob Lynn. John, the course you were taking itself, where you were majoring in physics, and how did it develop the further on you went, if that makes sense to you? What were your interests more?
Oh, well, in an undergraduate course, you then followed a fairly well-defined program. We had no, as I recall it, no choice as to of units or topics, choice of subjects across the faculty, and I chose to do geology in the first year, and then tried to do geology as well in the second. It's an extra in the second year. It was too much to do. By the time we got to honours, then we were all expected to do a research type project for honours, not quite so formal as we do now. And when I look at my, I still have my honours project report, which Kerr Grant gave back to me. unless this was a fair copy, it's possible. It was a bit scruffy, and the demands were not very high. But it was a research type project, and it introduced honours students to the idea of tackling the world around them on issues that they're not actually familiar with, and making use of particular techniques and all the rest of it. And I looked for after I took my honours, I looked around for a project to get a master's degree. Mm. So I was going to stay on in Adelaide. And I found a very interesting article in Physical Review on liquid crystals. I mean, these are now very, very important. LCD television sets and all the rest of it. Yeah. But then they were a curiosity. Also, there was at that time, reactors were now becoming available for, nuclear reactors were available for civil use. And it was suggested that beams of neutrons could be used to give diffraction patterns for crystals in the same way that X-rays could. I mean, Bragg's idea with X-rays, but using neutrons, because the neutrons have a wavelength. If they're slow enough, the wavelength is comparable with the dimensions of a crystal, and crystals can be studied by using neutron diffraction. And at Lucas Heights now, there's quite a big a big program been running on HIFAR, and there will be an even bigger one on OPAL when that runs. And I thought that this would be interesting. Looking back on it, it was ridiculous, because I really couldn't anticipate being able to go anywhere to do do neutron diffraction. But at least I started studying liquid crystals, and I started making apparatus for detecting neutrons, and I did detect neutrons and did a number of quite interesting lecture demonstrations of one sort and another. And then CSIR decided that they should establish a small group in Melbourne University under Professor Martin on atomic physics. So they established an atomic physics section, and although I hadn't completed my master's degree, the sort of work that I was doing was exactly the sort of thing that the Atomic Energy Commission was interested in, and which I thought they would be working on. And so I saw this as a much more interesting thing to do than to hang around in the physics department. Now, my intention had been to get a master's degree and to do what Oliphant had done, to get a 1851 scholarship and go overseas. And that was a very common way of getting overseas from Australia in that era. But I got in touch with CSIR, as it was then, And Fred White interviewed me in the Elder Hall at an ANZAS conference. That would have been, say, August of 46 or thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a very, I made a formal application for the position and was offered it. So Bill Glasick from Melbourne University and I were the first two people appointed in Australia to take part in an atomic energy program.
John, before you go on with that, can I just take you back to your undergraduate years at Adelaide and then we'll come back to CSIR? You've spoken about your studies. What about the life at union and life with sport? What are the activities you pursued there?
I feel very sick about the misunderstanding of the way the federal government misunderstands what student unionism is.
Mm.
Admittedly, I worked in a small university. The university now is 10,000 students, it's more than that, but in terms of undergraduates, it's not much more than 10,000 now. And so it's not so easy to make friends and join into activities, but the university was a hive of extracurricular activities in my days. I was president of the men's union and vice president of the student union in the year that Sam Jacobs was the president. I was very active in the student Christian movement. I was the treasurer. I don't think I ever went any higher in office than the treasurer. I found the student Christian movement extremely formative. I changed many of my views on the way the world worked as a result of the association with the student Christian movement. And I was interested to see, for example, in comments that the last week or the week before, they had the 50th anniversary for the 1956 graduates. And they had a ceremony in Bonython Hall. and I went along to represent the Dean of Science. And a lot of the 1956 students, quite a lot of them, commented on the fact that they had been a member of the SCM. Now, I don't know quite when that faded out because I'd left Adelaide then.
Mm.
But it was a very, very strong organisation and it had a white ant policy.
Meaning?
meaning that concerned members of the SCM should get onto the union to make sure that they behave themselves. That's not quite the right way of putting it, but there were one or two rat bags on the campus that created chaos, and not mayhem, but who had views that conservative people like me and my friends didn't approve of, like the Labour Club, I suppose, some of the firebrands in the Labour Club. And members of the SCM were enjoined to get themselves elected to the union. It wasn't called the Students' Representative Council to counteract any other deleterious effects that might occur.
John, the union was divided into for men and women, wasn't it?
Well, yes and no. There was a men's union and there was the women's union and there was the union.
Yes.
And the union, of course, had both staff and students on it.
Yes.
The student members were elected, and the president of the president of both the men's and women's unions were elected by the relevant constituencies. Mm. So I served on the union council. No, it's just on the union, I suppose. I remember the early days of the NUAUS, National Union of Australian University Students, in which, in the dying days of the war, but maybe just after the war, in fact, it probably was, when the Commonwealth Government was actually, believe this or not, they paid the fares of councillors from different parts of the states to a general meeting of NUAUS in Sydney. I also was a member of the Science Association. I was secretary and president of the Science Association, and that was very strong. The point being, I think, that it was a small university. You knew everybody in your year in science, or in whatever faculty you were. Everybody in your year. You knew nearly everybody in your faculty. And I reckon I could honestly say that I knew everybody in the Faculty of Science, at least by sight. I mean, I can't remember their names now, but and I may be fooling myself, but I reckon I knew everybody in my year in all faculties. That's arts, medicine, engineering, and science, and knew everybody in the Faculty of Science. Now that's not impossible. It's something which we would like to have now, but which is, I think, beyond us.
You mentioned about SCM being formative.
Yeah.
Who were some of the people you recall there?
Oh. I can't remember the names of the... We had a residential SCM secretary, and I can't remember who it was. I can remember the names of some of the people who were in the... who were in the SCM with me at the same time as I was, and I can see some faces, but I can't, without looking them up, I can't remember their names.
Was Baz Hetzel still involved with it, or had he moved on?
No, I knew Basil and Peter Hetzel from the SCM, but he was not one. Well, he would have been one of the leaders. Of course, he was 3 or 4 years older than I.
Yes.
He was, of course, I think, still in medicine at that time, but he would have been. He was significant in the SCM. Yes.
Mm. I was just trying to think of that period, and it was made up mainly of a study times and then a conference. Is that right?
There was a national conference, and. And I think probably in my honours year, I rode my bicycle to Melbourne to go to the SCM conference with John Keeves and Doug Stelly. We cheated a little bit. We took the train to Mount Gambier and rode the rest of the way.
It's still a feat.
Oh yeah. No, just a minute. That's not quite true. We cheated on the way back a bit, but we rode nearly all the way over, now I remember, yes. Of course, we went through Caniva. We didn't go to Mount Gambier. We came back through Mount Gambier.
So, John, we digressed a little bit.
Yeah.
Thank you for talking about that. And I know you also played sport, I think, at the time at university, but the move to CSIR in Melbourne and your meeting with Professor Martin was also pretty pivotal for you, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I had a great respect for Professor Martin. He was in charge of a nuclear physics research program in Melbourne, and that was the reason why CSIR decided to locate their division, their section in its laboratory, in a sort of reminiscence of the way in which the soils division of CSIR developed from association with my father here in Adelaide. And eventually, I went over to do nuclear physics, and the CSIR were not terribly fussy what sort of nuclear physics it was that people should become acquainted with the language of nuclear physics and the techniques of nuclear physics, and just exactly what people did was left to Professor Martin and Bill Lassick helped to develop a Betatron, not a very fancy one, but it's an accelerator. And it happened that Professor Moore, he was Associate Professor Moore, had just joined the physics department, and Martin suggested to me that I should go and talk to Dr. Moore and see whether there was anything that he was doing that I might be interested in, and there was. And so I did a project on cosmic rays, which is in fact nuclear physics, and the techniques are very definitely nuclear physics. It surprises people to discover that Moore was my supervisor, because Moore is always correctly regarded as a theoretician. But he had brought with him an experimental program in cosmic rays that he was interested in. And I've had interest in cosmic rays ever since.
When you were with CSIR, did you have any idea where you would go forward, if you like, or what you wanted to do?
No, I think I just played it by ear. It was interesting. I was doing things that I was interested in. It was fun, and I guess I got a PhD. Bill Lassick and I both got PhDs. Working for CSIR, and that didn't set any precedents. It did, I suppose. We were the first two physics PhDs in Australia. At least so everybody tells us, and so I believe. Nobody's contradicted it. I've never claimed it, but people tell me it's true.
So just being 1950, you got your PhD?
Yes, 1950. And then I applied for an Australian National University scholarship to go overseas, which Professor Martin managed to, I won't say organise for me, but spoke very, very strongly to get me to go. So I went to Oxford. That was interesting because the traditional stream to go for nuclear physics would be to go to Cambridge, in Rutherford's place. Oliphant was no longer there, of course. We had a visitor from England. I don't remember who he was. He gave a talk in the physics department, and he said that he thought that Oxford was the up-and-coming nuclear physics university, and that Cambridge was running down. And I'm sure he was absolutely correct in nuclear physics. Both of them, the two were absolutely dead-level runners for low-temperature physics. But in terms of nuclear physics, Oxford was the better. And when I after suitable correspondence, I got to Oxford, and I went to see Colley, C.H. Colley. And he said to me something along the following lines. When he said, Prescott, he said, I know you already have a PhD, but he said, I've had you accepted into my college, Christchurch. He said, I think you should do a DPhil. An Oxford degree is always useful. And that's pretty much how he sounded. And so I did a DPhil in Oxford. I ran out of ANU scholarship money, and Oliphant, bless his heart, and Titterton refused to renew it. And so the Oxford found me 6 months' stipend to complete my DPhil. It was a Nuffield, called it a Nuffield fellowship. So I got my DPhil, and then I came back to Adelaide to Melbourne, with a new set of nuclear physics skills, which I then proceeded to make use of in Melbourne. and things went on quite well. And very shortly after I got back in 1953, the Commonwealth Government set up the Atomic Energy Commission, and Bill Lassick and I, and a number of others who had been appointed since, were transferred into the Atomic Energy Commission. In the meantime, CSIR had become CSIRO, come 1954-55, they'd set up operations in Sydney at Cronulla. They'd acquired a large patch of land on the hills overlooking the Warranora River in Sutherland, Shire of Sutherland, Lucas Heights. And they took me up there to have a look at the place and drove me out into the bush. And I saw this large area of bush surrounded by a cyclone fence. And I decided that I liked the university life better than that. And so I talked to Les Martin, and he says, "Well, look, I think you are suited to university life. We can probably find you a job here, but if you can get a job overseas, it's closer to the centre of gravity of physics, and you would find it much more formative." And so I got a job, I applied for a job at the University of British Columbia. It was looking for somebody with pretty much my qualifications.
So it was really seeing Lucas Heights that made you think again.
That was the trigger. I think probably not very deep in my heart of hearts, I knew I wanted to be an academic.
Were you married by this time,
John? Oh yes, I was married long before I went to. I was married shortly after I went to Melbourne, actually. Mm. So when we went to Oxford, I already had a son, a small son who was three, in our first year in Oxford. And my elder daughter was born in Oxford. So my wife had a pretty rough time, I think, for 2 or 3 years.
And how did she feel about going to University of British Columbia?
Oh, she didn't like leaving her family. Mm-hmm. Which is understandable. I didn't feel the same way about leaving my parents, and my mother, bless her heart, said to Joe, when she was engaged, before she was actually married, something along the following lines: "Well, you know, you're going to have to get used to the Prescotts. You write the word Prescott on a suitcase and it walks away." Or words to that effect.
Yeah.
And my wife still tells me, I would say constantly, often tells this story. Because it's actually, if you look at my father's sisters and brothers, they were all over the place. Mm. And my grandfather, as I say, went to France, he went to Italy, he turned down an opportunity to go to Japan. So the Prescotts have been that particular branch of them, a travelling family.
Now, John, for how long were you in Canada?
15 years altogether. Five years at British Columbia, University of British Columbia, and 10 years at the University of Calgary.
Did you extend your work on cosmic rays at that time?
Well, no. When I went, the reason I was appointed, it was interesting. I didn't know this at the time, but John Warren was on study leave at ANU, and he came down to interview me in Melbourne. And they were actually looking for somebody who had experience in high energy physics, which of course is cosmic rays, because they were hoping to get a high energy accelerator in British Columbia. There was a good deal of talk in Canada, as I discovered later, about Canada being involved in high energy physics, and that there was a feeling in the West Coast that it would be built somewhere else, and so they lobbied very strongly to have a high energy accelerator in Vancouver, and the federal government went through some quite significant motions about finding out what it would cost and all the rest of it, and then decided it was too expensive, when I left to go to Calgary, either Shrum or Warren or somebody said, "Well, it's a pity the high energy physics didn't work out." But the reason I think why they appointed me was that I had experience in cosmic rays, but I'd also had experience in accelerator physics. There you are. But then I went to Calgary, and they were looking for somebody who was interested in cosmic rays. I got back into it again, and I've continued with it on and off until not long after I retired from Adelaide.
John, did you have a desire to come back to Australia, or would you not have cared?
Well, the answer is to the first is yes, I would have liked to come back to Australia. But if it had turned out differently, I wouldn't have been too upset. Hmm. I enjoyed it in Canada. I like Canadians. I like their way of life. it has in some, it's in some respects, it's a more egalitarian society than Australia, at least Western Canada. If it weren't for the climate, which is pretty grim in the winter, it's a good place to live. The standard of living, of course, is much better. You buy a car for half the price you'd pay in Australia, and things of that kind. But I was concerned about my parents, both of whom were alive.
Yes.
My wife was anxious to, she was anxious to come back because her father was still alive, although her mother had died, and she didn't like the thought of growing old in Canada. But if I'd had to stay, I don't think I'd have been too upset.
Now, as it turned out, I think the professorial chair in physics in Adelaide was it resigned in 1970, is that right?
It could have been 1969 or thereabouts. Ken McCracken was the second professor of physics.
Yeah.
And he decided he would go back to the United States. In fact, that fell through, but the chair was vacant.
Mm. Where were you interviewed, John, for that job?
In Adelaide.
They flew you back, did they?
The answer is no. I was coming to Adelaide for a holiday.
Oh.
And they took advantage of my being here. So I went through all of the usual steps, like giving a lecture and talking to the registrar and the vice chancellor and having the superannuation scheme explained to me and all the rest of it. Mm. And when I left, nobody said boo. It's interesting. Nobody said boo, for which I conclude that I was probably not head of the shortlist, top of the shortlist, yeah. But be that as it may, I said to my wife, well, that was worth a try. Mm. So I went home to Canada and applied for Canadian citizenship.
Oh.
And before that process had gone through, I had a cable from Angelo offering me the chair in Adelaide.
Oh, Vic Angelo?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How did you find him?
Hmm?
How did you find
him? Oh, much the same as I remember him from 25 years earlier. What he says, it'll be nice to see you back again after a quarter of a century.
Yeah, I've heard so many stories about him. He seemed to have quite a relationship with different academics.
Oh, well, he knew everything. I mean, nothing happened in the university that Angelo didn't know about.
Mm.
He was, I mean, it's a university of the old style. Once he retired, the university changed. I mean, having a professional vice-chancellor, of course, that was a big change. That was a big change. That took place after I left,
yes.
Not as an undergrad, when I wasn't an undergraduate anymore. I was here when Edgelo retired, and the university then, the administration of the university then began to develop in a different way.
Yeah. John, did you take up your chair in 71? Was that right?
Yeah, I think probably August 71. Yeah. Yeah.
Had the place changed a lot from when you'd previously known it?
Well, the answer is yes and no. It still had much the same sort of structures that it had before, except that they were bigger. And I'd have to say that I've just said that the major changes that it seemed to me began to show followed sometime after Angelo retired, when it became quite clear that it wasn't possible for a registrar, an assistant registrar, and a bursar. And an assistant bursar to run the university.
Mm.
And at that time, when I came back, that's the way the university more or less ran that way. It was a much more relaxed, much less formal. I remember, for example, talking to John Carver, and John Carver says, I'm going to recommend Joe Doakes for promotion to senior lecturer. I said, oh, that's okay. He said, what do you think about that? I said, well, that sounds all right to me. And And in fact, he simply wrote a letter to the registrar saying, I recommend Joe Doakes for promotion to senior lecturer. Just like that.
Mm.
Didn't say because his teaching is exemplary, because he has a very long research record, because he acts on university committees. That changed, but that was after I came back. One of the big changes that was beginning to take place when I came back was the elected heads of departments. When I came back, all heads of departments were appointed for life. I was the first elected head of the physics department. And technically, I wasn't the elected head of the physics department. I was appointed by council, but I insisted that we have an informal vote within the department to say that I was acceptable. So that doesn't count, I suppose, but it does to me.
Was there a push to sort of, for want of a better word, the democratisation of departments at the time?
Yes, that began pretty much about the time I came back, the early 70s.
Yeah, well, so were students wanting to be on departments then too, or not?
Well, there were student representations for representation on council. I'm not sure when they got to be there. When I was an undergraduate, we made a representation that the students should be, that there should be students on council, and the council sort of laughed at it. So we then asked, well, could we have copies of the agendas? And they said, don't be ridiculous, politely. But and that didn't happen until many years later.
Right.
But I'm a great believer in the student viewpoint. Often not very well informed, but often quite well informed. And on some things, they know more about the university than the administration does.
Now, John, what about your own research specialties? Were you able to pursue those when you came back here?
Yeah, pretty much. The Australian Research Council, it was called the ALGC then, I think, was beginning to provide support for research within departments. The university had a research fund, which it no longer has, not quite under those terms. And I was able to bring some of my apparatus from Canada. The particular experiment that I was working on was no longer to be continued. And so I brought the relevant stuff with me, and a PhD and a postdoctoral fellow. And the university found money for him until he got a Queen Elizabeth Fellowship. And they gave me a setting up grant, which for its day was not really great, but was quite adequate. So I didn't have any trouble getting my research project started again. I inherited a project from Ken McCracken, a balloon-borne cosmic ray experiment, and Peter Davidson was still on the staff at that stage as a research fellow. But the ARGC said, well, you're going to have to make up your mind. I applied for both, money for both the balloon experiment and for the extensive air shower experiment that I brought the apparatus. And they said, well, assuming that these are both equally meritorious and you have to make a choice, which choice would you make? And so they agreed to wind down to provide enough funds. I think this is right, I'd have to check the correspondence. To wind down the balloon project, but they gave me AIGC gave me quite good support for the other project, and as I say, Roger Clay got a Queen Elizabeth Fellowship, and he's now a full professor here.
Did Did you enjoy building equipment?
Yes, yes. I'm a great believer in the idea that the world is three-dimensional, and I like making things, and I'm not as good as some people. I'm particularly these days on integrated circuits and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. There are people who are very, very much better than I am at that, and I let them do it.
Now, John, there were three of the things we talked about that were of great interest to me in your time as professor there. One of those was that you took an interest in medical physics itself and really gave it a couple of opportunities it wouldn't have otherwise got.
Yes. One of the things that distresses me is that the Faculty of Medicine have decided that it's not necessary for doctors to know any physics. Other than what they might have learned in year 12. Well, that's better than nothing. But at the time I came back here, the medical students were doing Physics 1, the regular Physics 1 course, which was not designed specifically for medical students. It didn't do them any harm altogether. But the Faculty of Medicine itself said, look, there's a lot of stuff in here which is clearly of no use to us. We're not interested in it. We'll teach it ourselves, or words to that effect. And this put the cat among the pigeons. And John Carver, I think, began it, and then I picked it up because he then went on study leave, and in consultation with John Veal from the Department of Physiology. Mm-hmm. We devised a new syllabus for medical physics and taught it as a separate subject. And in the first year, John and I taught it together. We were both there nearly all the time. And I talked about the physics and he talked about the physiology and its application. Though I say it who shouldn't, I think I helped rescue medical physics for the physics department. That sounds a bit like empire building, and it is. We don't like to lose students. And I think, in fact, I think medical students need to know quite a lot of physics, and for sure that a lot more physics than some of their seniors think they should know. And then some years later, after an unfortunate decision was made about who should teach medical physics, and the situation began again. The person teaching it was actually was a good physicist, but was unprepared to recognise that he was teaching medical students and not physicists. And I then had to do another rescue job. Yeah. But it's interesting, quite a number of the first year experiments in our laboratories got there because they had a genesis in the medical physics course.
Mm. Well, John, those laboratories themselves, you were also very involved in improving them for first year students.
Well, I was very keen on first year labs, yes.
So did that take quite a time to push through?
I'm not sure you've got the right phrase about pushing through.
Well,
if you're going to do anything properly, you've got to spend time on it.
I was trying to ask, in a nice way, were you a loner in supporting this?
Oh, no, I wasn't. One of my more enthusiastic collaborators was John Patterson. Mm-hmm. And I won't name one of my more unenthusiastic collaborators who did more harm than good. But John Patterson and I ran the... did a lot of work together in the first year laboratories, and have actually published papers on first year laboratory work. And then he carried on after I was decided I had other things to do. Mm. But most of my involvement in undergraduate laboratories was with first year, and not in to some extent in second year, and rather thinly in third year.
A couple of other things to talk about with you, and maybe more, John, but how did you set up that collaboration with Utah University? That's fascinated me.
Oh, well, I think when we last talked, I mentioned this is something which I look back on after somebody said, well, what do you think was the most important things you did while you were in office? And I got to know some of the people at the University of Utah, Fred Coifel, for example, Jack Coifel.
How do you spell that name?
Coifel, K-E-U-F-F-E-L. Mm. He died prematurely, but he had a good imagination for ambitious projects. He set up an underground experiment, which, in fact, was not quite as successful as it might have been, but which certainly appealed to me, and that this was while I was still in Canada, and so I made a visit to Utah, and then on one of my first study leaves, I think from Adelaide. I decided I'd go back there. I'd already been there twice for relatively short visits. I decided I'd take some study leave in Utah. And the reason why I wanted to do that was that they were beginning to set up a quite ambitious project for studying extensive air showers, which is the sort of thing we'd been doing. We'd been doing some work at Buckland Park, extending a different method into the study of showers by looking at the light produced in the atmosphere by at night, moonless nights, by cosmic rays coming down. Mm. It produces flashes of light, and we measured them out there. But the people at Utah were getting, they had a big show, and they had a lot more money. And so I decided I'd go and spend a period of study leave there to see what they were doing. Jack Coifel was still alive at that time, but he died very shortly afterwards. And it happened that there was someone in physiology, that was one of the medical faculties. One of the medical departments, but let's call it physiology, was also doing some work on excuse me, luminescence, and so I got in their good books by giving them some advice on luminescence, which was something I knew something about as well, and then when they had vacancies for postdoctoral fellows, a number of our Adelaide PhD graduates went over to Utah, and so we've had this interchange of personnel, and now certainly in my absence, a significant joint involvement in the Auger project, which is running in South America at the moment.
Now, how do you pronounce that?
Auger, French, A-U-G-E-R, Auger. He was the man who discovered cosmic rays,
right.
Cosmic ray showers. Excuse me, let me have a drink of water. Have I put you to sleep yet?
No, not at all, John. No. Well, this actually leads me into that another point I find of particular interest: your work on luminescence dating that involved you in other work with the South Australian Museum.
Yeah. One of my side non-physics interests for years has been archaeology of one sort and another, and I can just a sort of a conditioned reflex. I can't not look at pictures on television for archaeology, or read articles in books about archaeology. I'm interested in it. I was born within sight of the pyramids, for goodness sake. and so not long after we came back, it'd be 1973, my wife and I answered an advertisement which appeared on the notice of the staff club for diggers to help with the archaeological excavations at Runka on the River Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up and helped excavate, scratching sand away and lifting bones and artifacts and shells and flint and that sort of stuff. It happens that there's a big reunion coming up this next Saturday for former Runka workers. And one night over the campfire, I asked Graham Pretty from the South Australian Museum whether there was anything which he thought the physics department could do to help his research project. And he said, yes, well, he just read about something called thermoluminescence dating, which is being developed at Oxford, and he thought it would have a good application in Australia. Now, I hadn't the faintest idea what thermoluminescence was, let alone thermoluminescence dating. But it happened that the person that was doing it was Martin Aitken, who was one of my fellow students in Oxford when I was there. So I knew him quite well. And next time I was overseas for a cosmic ray conference, I decided to call on him and find out what it was he was actually doing. And it sounded interesting, and I decided that I would put it up as an honors project for one of our honors students. And when it was clear that it was a non-trivial exercise and that there was real physics in it, I decided I would try and develop the physics side of luminescence dating, which I've done, and which I decided fairly rapidly was going to be what I wanted to do after I finally retired. So I, in fact, ran some parallel programs in cosmic ray physics and luminescence dating, and occasionally they overlap. And as I got closer and closer to retirement, the cosmic ray interest narrowed down a bit and the luminescence thing widened out a bit. And finally, a year or two after I retired, the astrophysics side of it simply stopped, and I continued on with luminescence dating as I do now, or the physics of it, and the physics and practice of it.
So I'm just looking back over all those years that you've known the university, right from your very early days, living just off crossroads down here. What is the biggest change? And I don't just mean in student numbers. What's the biggest change that you can see from that early day? I'm just wondering, is it the fact that you knew everybody there in those early years?
The thing I find, that's a really quite a nice piece of prompting, and also when you say, apart from the number of students, that the biggest impression of the university is that the campus is covered in buildings. Now that's a big difference, but the interaction between students and staff is much less than it used to be. The number of staff that go into the staff club is relatively small, so I don't get to talk to too many people outside physics or thereabouts. That's my wife trying to get in. The concept that the university is a business, which unfortunately the university has accepted and maybe has to accept, and that we are not producing student-qualified graduates, that we are educating, that we are teaching customers. distresses me. Distresses me, and I see my colleagues in the physics department overworked. I'd say grossly overworked. They don't have time for the niceties. They just have to teach, and if they're not teaching, they have to do lots of research so they can get lots of money. And they do talk occasionally. I'm sure some of them talk to other people outside the department. Mm. The other thing that bothers me about physics, and I think this is true for chemistry, and it's almost certainly true in the biological sciences, is the university no longer provides technical support for physics. We in fact have a computing officer. We have no electronic, not true. We have one electronic technician who is attached to a research group. When he retires, that post will be lost. He's exceptionally good. We have enough staff paid by the university, just enough, to cover our undergraduate teaching. We have a person in the workshop who's in a position to look after the teaching laboratories, although that's shared around a bit. And the other people in the workshop are paid by research grants. Mm. And this is a very serious misallocation of resources. Mm. I mean, science can't work on that basis, and to say that if you're going to do any research work, you've got to find every penny of it yourself. The university can't afford to help you. Yeah, well, we'll provide the building, and at the moment we do in fact pay for the electricity bills, but the University of New South Wales is charging departments rent for their accommodation. I kid you not. We don't do that yet. Well, it's been suggested.
So, John, the world has changed rather greatly since you first knew the university.
Yes.
Without doubt.
Yeah, it has.
Thank you very much for being willing to put your memories on tape for the future people of the university.
Yep.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
And you must come back some other time and I'll put in the other bits that are left out. Well, I hope.